I'm sorry to inform you that I got admitted to hospital on Sunday, the 28th of February 1915, from the effects of a bomb on a 26. I had my platoon in a reserve trench when the enemy started putting a heavy rifle fire and some bombs into our firing line trench to my left front. I at once made my men stand to, when I could hear a cry for help from the trench that had heavy fire on them. I made my mind up at once to try and reach my comrades. Well, to reach them, I had to go across an open space of ground in full view of the enemy about 150 yards. So I started to make a run for it. But as soon as I started, the enemy, put volley after volley over me, but thank God they missed their target. I reached my comrades all right. It was a pitiful sight that met my gaze. But thanks be to God, they were all cool. I at once ordered rapid fire and started getting the wounded out. When I finished, I thought I had better go back and report to my captain, who was reading the burial service over a poor fellow who'd got killed that morning. I started back when the enemy again sent volley after volley, but again missed their mark, so I suppose they thought they would make sure of me this time and sent over a bomb, which hit where I was crouching and knocked me up in the air. When I came to my senses, I started to feel myself, and to my great joy, that I was in one solid piece but covered with mud. The puzzle was how to get back to my own trench. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And that passage that I've just read to you there was written in a letter back home in South Wales by a man called James Murphy, who was serving with the 4th Battalion of the Middlesex Regiment in February of 1915. And he was serving to the south of Ypres in the shadow of what was to become the Messines Ridge, which had been taken by the Germans in the autumn of 1914. And now the front lines were opposite each other, with, of course, the Germans holding the high ground. And last week, I guided a man called David Murphy in the footsteps of James, who was his great-grandfather. And we went to the very location where that action took place. But there's much more to this story. There's much more to the pilgrimage that I led David on, not just looking at the story of James, who happily came back to his home in South Wales, but to two other relatives of his that weren't so fortunate, that both died on the Western Front during the Great War. We follow their story as well, and along the way, we find all sorts of other incredible stories that I want to share with you today. We're only on the Western Front for 3 days, but the stories that I brought back will live with me forever, and I hope that you'll enjoy listening to them today. But before we go any further, I think what I better do is give a good plug out to the sponsor of this podcast, a company called Ativo, who have really helped me have the time to devote to Great War research, taking people over to the battlefield and doing the research and recording this podcast. Because since I was 21 years old, I'd been paying into my pension, and now I'm 60, Ativo have managed my financial affairs, meaning that I don't have to worry about my monthly income because it comes through various pensions that I've been paying into. Ativo, enriching lives through lifestyle financial planning. Lifestyle financial planning is about more than just focused financial advice. It's a tailored, holistic approach centered on your unique aspirations, individual circumstances, and evolving needs. By building a lifelong relationship based on trust and getting to know you, Ativo works with you to craft a bespoke financial plan that helps you live the style of life that you want. Their experienced, highly qualified financial specialists and expert support teams are committed to delivering more for all of their clients. It's clear, independent advice that sets them apart, helping their clients to unlock their unrealised financial potential, giving them the confidence to lead financially secure and enriched lives. To find out more, contact them through their website, www.ativo.co.uk. So now let's go back to that field near Wyshatter, the place that the British Tommies called Wysheet, that was to become famous over 2 years after the event that we're talking about now. We left Sergeant James Murphy trying to get back to his own trenches, being fired at by the Germans. A bomb had exploded. He thought he was in one piece. He dusted himself down, and if you recall, he was trying to work out what to do next. The puzzle, he says, was how to get back to my own trench. There was only one thing for it, and that was to get in a communication trench full of frozen water and mud. But I made a dive into it and got back after a struggle. Our boys gave it to those bounders. The dirty tykes even shelled the burial party. Our artillery opened into the bounders then and gave them a hot time and silenced their guns. Well, I've got recommended. What he means by that, he's been recommended for the Distinguished Conduct Medal for bravery. He said, may I add, this is the second time I've been recommended. So they've packed me into a hospital for a little rest, for I had a bit of a shock and shaking up. Well, as soon as I landed in hospital, I could hear two fellows talking. One of them said, what are you talking, man? My ears flew back and I thought, thank God, a voice from Wales. It was the first I'd heard since leaving England. How strange. And thousands of Welshmen here. In fact, they were fighting on our left. I at once turned to the speaker and found that he was from Merthyr and his name was Hughes. Well, enough about myself and Hughes. Well, I suppose you've heard about the gallant stand of the plucky little Welsh regiment at, and then the name of the place is crossed out because of security fears. I'm sorry to say there are not many of them left, and although the enemy was at least 10 to 1, the enemy, never broke through the lines. I know there'll be many a sorrowful home in Wales, but I hope and pray that the respective relatives, when mourning their loss, will have some comfort in knowing that their sons, brothers and fathers died fighting honourably and clean and accounted for many a dirty Hun. Will you please call in at my home, number 80 Victoria Street, and let my missus know I'm getting on fine. Please don't answer this, as I don't know where I will be, but will write to you later on. He sounds quite a character, doesn't he, that man? And when you look at his photo, you can see that he was. A photo I'll put on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. And he was indeed recommended and accepted for the Distinguished Conduct Medal. The citation reads, for conspicuous gallantry on the 26th of February 1915, when he crossed an open space of 50 yards within 150 yards of the enemy, who were firing heavily in order to re-establish order in a trench, the garrison of which had been thrown into confusion by the enemy bombs. Sergeant Murphy, after re-establishing order, returned across the open space and reported to his officer. He's really shown leadership there, this non-commissioned officer. Taking his own life into his own hands, he's seen that there's chaos and panic in that frontline trench. Although this was early in the war, he'd seen service abroad in South Africa at the turn of the century during the Boer War. He knew what those men were going through and he was determined to do something about it. And that's exactly what he did, and that's why he was awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal. I wonder how many of these events took place on the Western Front and beyond without anybody witnessing it. And therefore, those actions of heroism have gone unreported. That's why it's important that we tell these stories on this podcast. James Murphy's not a famous man. I wouldn't have known anything about it if his relative hadn't contacted me through this podcast and we ended up on the battlefield following in his footsteps. It was almost 2 years later before he was eventually awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal. The ceremony took place at a skating rink in Cardiff in front of a large contingent. And the ceremony was performed by Colonel James Aspinall Turner, the garrison commander who'd seen action also during the Second Boer War in South Africa. After the ceremony, James returned home to Victoria Street and he was met at the train station by a large crowd who'd gathered to give him a hero's welcome. And they escorted him home, accompanied by an ambulance band. Once home, speeches were made in his honour by Councillor Pennant and C.R. Haycock, to which James responded, and then the national anthem was sung. And these accounts that I'm reading to you today, I read to David, James's great-grandson, as we stood in that field where that action had taken place. In the distance, we could see the Messines Ridge, where those 19 mines were blown over 2 years later. But there was nothing in that field to indicate what had happened. There was nothing in that field to indicate that anything happened ever in that field. There was a road that dissected the two fields where the front lines were. That road went up to the Messines Ridge. We stood at the base of that, where those Middlesex trenches were, those two lines that James crossed in order to restore order in those frontline trenches, where he came back, where we later found out, or he later found out, he'd actually been hit by one of those bombs, one of those shells. It was very quiet. It was late afternoon. There was no one around. And then we saw, as we parked on the side of the road in a farm track, a farmer came along the road, heading from what was the German lines in our direction. And he slowed down, wondered, I suppose, what we were doing on the side of his field. And then he saw the number plate in our car. He saw what we were doing and he shouted out, "Ah, English," and he waved. And off he went, doing his business. And then David asked how I'd managed to locate the location of where this action took place. And I must admit, it was quite a challenge. What we normally do is turn to various published sources. There's a series of books written by Andrew Rawson that are particularly helpful. But most of the books were silent because this was an insignificant day. Nothing of any major importance occurred. So we turned to the battalion diary and handwritten, scribbled really, 26 of the 2nd, 15, it just tells us it was a quiet day and the battalion was relieved by the 2nd Battalion of the Royal Scots in the trenches in the evening. The morning was very bright. They always mention the weather. There were no casualties during the relief, but just before one of the trenches was relieved, the enemy dropped a bomb from a Minenwaffe. Trench mortars that the soldiers feared, it says it dropped into the trench, it killed one man and wounded two others. One other man was killed during the day, but it doesn't tell us where they were. But there was a clue there, wasn't there? I feel like a detective sometimes. The clue was they'd relieved the 2nd Battalion of the Royal Scots. So, quickly, turn, obviously they were serving in the same brigade. So I went to their battalion diary and there was another handwritten record, but this time much neater and with more information. The Royal Scots diary tells us that in the evening at 6:30, they marched out to relieve the 4th Middlesex in the M sector in trenches near Wierstrat. It tells us it was a bright moonlit night, and that the trenches that they were serving in were on the south side of the Wierstrat to Weishat road. And that road, as I said, is still there. It was easy then, as we drove down it towards Weishatter, to determine that the right-hand side of the road was the south side. And that was the clue that we needed to locate the exact position. Trench maps weren't really of much use. I've got the digital linesman device that we use, and we did use later on in this tour, as we'll see later on in the podcast. But there weren't that many detailed trench maps available this early in the war. This is only February of 1915. The trench system had only been established for 3 or 4 months at this stage. But thankfully, that handwritten entry in the Royal Scots Battalion diary gave us the evidence, gave us the clue that we needed to take David to the very spot that his great-grandfather had carried out that very brave action that was to see him rewarded. And of course, had he been killed, had that bomb killed him, or one of those bullets killed him, he wouldn't have survived. David's family history would have been very different. And as we noted when we stood there, David wouldn't have been standing there because he wouldn't have been born, would he? His grandfather wouldn't have been born. His father wouldn't have been born. He wouldn't have been there. That fickle finger of fate that we follow so many times when we're following the journey of these men on the Western Front and beyond. But there was another story that had come through the family of the Murphys, and it was a story that James, when he returned home, that told David's mother, his youngest daughter, who was called Eileen. And that was the story of a young lad aged 19, Private William Scotton, who was one of those guilty of desertion and put to death by firing squad. James witnessed this event and he told his family that he looked so young. He was young. He was just 19 and he wondered whether he'd lied about his age to join up. This execution had occurred 3 weeks before James had carried out the action that resulted in being awarded the DCM Distinguished Conduct Medal. William Scotton was born in Liverpool in 1892 and he'd enlisted in the army at the end of July 1914, just before the outbreak of the war. And his younger brother joined up the same day in Bootle in Liverpool. Albert joins the Liverpool regiment, his local regiment, and William, for some reason, joined the Middlesex. After a brief period of training, he was drafted in to the 4th Battalion of the Middlesex and sent to serve with them in the Ypres Salient, or what had become the Ypres Salient, in December of 1914. But within a few weeks, at the end of the month, he'd gone absent, and he repeated the offence a month later on the 23rd of January 1915. And in his absence, the platoon had seen service in the front line. He returned to his unit a day after they returned from the front line, and he was therefore charged. And on the 28th of January 1915, he was tried for desertion and found guilty. He was therefore ordered to be shot at dawn, and the sentence was carried out at 7:05 on the 3rd of February 1915 in the village just behind where the front lines were at Weerstraat. The firing squad consisted of an NCO and 7 men from his own unit, and James told his family that they were all there. The whole battalion was there to see what happened as a warning to everybody else. It was a deterrent, wasn't it, to anyone contemplating cowardice or desertion. He was no doubt buried, but as the war had still got over 3 years to run, his body was lost. The court-martial papers suggest that the soldier was, in their words, a weakling, and that discipline in the battalion at that stage was poor. He has no known grave. He's one of the 54,000 that's remembered on the Menin Gate. Upon his return home, the local newspaper reported that he'd been awarded the DCM, and it said that he returned home to 80 Victoria Street, where his wife and 5 little children are waiting to welcome him home. And it turns out he'd been wounded in the thigh. Remember, he thought he hadn't been wounded when he dusted himself down. Paper says, "We all congratulate him upon his distinction and trust he'll be given a warm reception when he's granted leave for a short holiday." And of course, we know that he was. And whilst he was in the trenches, he wrote a letter to the local newspaper. This was later on in the war, thanking the local people, the local school children, for sending over home comforts, I suppose, including matches and cigarettes that the soldiers so valued to give them some comfort when they're in the trenches. He wrote this letter: "Just a line to thank you and all your schoolmates for your very kind present of cigarettes and matches, which were indeed appreciated very much by myself and my men. I can assure you it is a great comfort being out here in the trenches to learn how brave little mites are doing your best to help us defeat the foe. I should always like to thank your school teachers very much for their kindness. I cannot find suitable words to express my gratitude to you all, but you can all rest assured we out here will try our hardest, will try our best, and would willingly sacrifice our last drop of blood. Thanking you all once again." James went on to serve all the way through the war, and he became the Assistant Secretary of the British Legion in his locality and later became the actual Secretary, and he died in 1962. But what a legacy he left behind, a legacy that we've been able to follow, a journey that we've been able to follow on our battlefield tour a couple of weeks ago, and you've joined with us today. We've got some more stories to tell that we uncovered on our battlefield tour. But before we do that, let's pause and listen to a little bit more poetry, shall we?
"Break of Day in the Trenches" by Isaac Rosenberg. The darkness crumbles away. It is the same old druid time as ever. Only a live thing leaps my hand, a queer, sardonic rat, as I pull the parapet's poppy to stick behind my ear. Droll rat, they would shoot you if they knew your cosmopolitan sympathies. Now you have touched the English hand. You will do the same to a German soon, no doubt, if it be your pleasure to cross the sleeping green between. It seems you inwardly grin as you pass. Strong eyes, fine limbs, haughty athletes, less chanced than you for life. Bonds to the whim of murder, sprawled in the bowels of the earth, the torn fields of France. What do you see in our eyes? But the shrieking iron and flame hurled through still heavens. What quaver, what heart aghast? Poppies, whose roots are in men's veins, drop and are ever dropping, but mine in my ear is safe, just a little white with the dust.
So what we did then was to follow in the footsteps of another of David's relatives, this time on his mother's side, a soldier called George Scraggs, and he died a few miles north of where James had carried out his DCM action, just north of St Julian during the Battle for Langemark in August of 1917. By using the battalion diaries and the trench maps from the digital products, linesmen and other sources, we were hoping to find out exactly what had happened to him and stand on the very spot. David had been several years ago on a coach tour of the battlefields, and frustratingly for him, they weren't able to visit the battlefield where his relative had died, nor were they able to visit the New Irish Farms cemetery where he was buried. They actually went past the cemetery. The guide pointed out to him where he was buried, but they didn't have time to stop. Quite often don't on coach tours, but when we're on Terry's tours or individual tours, as I've said before, you can spend as long as you like. And that's exactly what we did. We spent several hours following the last few days of George Scragg. So who was he? He was serving with the 1st Battalion of the Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry. And he died on the 27th of August 1917, aged 30 years old. And as I said, he was buried in the vast New Irish Cemetery, and that's where we were going to end our journey. He was another one of those whose service records were not available. They'd been destroyed during the Blitz, but his medal index card revealed that he'd been awarded the Victory Medal and the British War Medal, but not the 1914-15 Star. And that tells us that he served overseas after, but not before, the 1st of January 1916. Now, the battle for Langemark began on the 16th of August 1917. It was really the second stage of the Third Battle of Ypres, Battle of Passchendaele. After the initial advance and success of the 31st of July, there was a pause, in which time it continued to rain and it made the battlefield almost impassable for soldiers and supplies and lorries and tanks. But the advance must go on, and it was planned for that day, the 16th of August. And George's unit were part of the 48th Division, and they were to advance on that morning between just north of St Julian, where the battle had come to an end on the 31st of July, along the banks of the Steenbeek. But what happened was, initially they made some progress. George, of course, was with them. But because of the conditions and because of the opposition provided by the Germans, firing out of strong defensive positions, lots of pillboxes around, lots of farms that they'd converted into defensive positions, the attack stalled and they ended up back where they started from. The commanding officer of the Royal Berkshires was called Lieutenant Colonel R.J. Clarke, and they were serving alongside George's battalion. And he wrote afterwards, "The attack pushed on in spite of all of the difficulties. The Hun chief defences here are a series of concrete gun pits and shelters, very strongly made and well scattered, so that each helps the others, and the machine gun fire was heavy. One of them was surrounded with water and marsh except one pathway to it. They will keep out all but the largest shells and hold about 20 to 30 men each. We found them very useful after we'd taken a few. The brigade did well, and especially the bucks. We were in reserve, although some of the companies got in for part of the fighting and did well. We found the Bavarians opposite us, and they fought well. There was none of that low morale that you read about. The ground was so bad that the tanks could not move to help us. If they had, we should have taken all of our objectives. For 2 days, Georgie's battalion held the line there in difficult circumstances. They still picked up a few casualties from artillery fire. The killing went on, even if the advance didn't. And 11 days later, on the 27th of August 1917, the battalion was ordered to attack across the same ground that they'd attacked before. It had continued to rain. It turned that ground into a muddy quagmire. The Steenbeek, which now still runs through that quiet farmland, had broken its banks. It added to the problems, and it was the Steenbeek that they had to cross before they could get at the German defenders. And this time the advance was to take place at 1:55 p.m. in broad daylight, middle of the afternoon. So using the evidence that we'd got with us, and especially the linesman device, which is a fantastic piece of kit, it's got hundreds and hundreds of the original trench maps loaded onto this device. And then there's a modern GPS signal on there as well. And that tells you exactly where you are in 1917 as well as in 2025. And from there, we knew that we were in the right place. The place that George spent the last day of his life, and that now his descendant, David, was now following in his footsteps. I think what took us by surprise, it's such a small area. There's so much going on here. There's so many men here. There's so many features that we could look at. The pillbox that the Lieutenant Colonel Clark mentioned, one of them was called Alberto, and it's still there to this day. When the crops are down, you can get to it through a minor road in the village of St. Julian, and that's exactly what we did. And we found ourselves standing on the very position that the battalion diary told us that George and his comrade had attacked from on that day, the 27th of August 1917. In front of us was the Steenbeek quietly meandering its way through the countryside. There was a steep but very short bank that led up to a farm, and lo and behold, that farm, Hillock Farm, is marked on the trench maps. It's still there, as I say, to this day. It was there then, it's there now. So the features around us were very much as described in the battalion diary and in some of the published accounts. And the narrative in the battalion diary is handwritten. And it tells us that George and his comrades moved up in support on the 27th, 3 hours after the initial attack had gone in. They arrived there at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And there they found really a situation of chaos after the initial attacking battalions had gone across that churned up ground. They were ordered to relieve those attacking, or those advanced troops of their brigade, but it says that their positions were in most cases difficult to find. The companies dug themselves in as best they could, and they were in and around Hillock Farm, which is exactly where we were standing, or just a few yards away anyway. They then discovered that very little progress had been made by those attacking troops. The battalion diary says, so far as could be ascertained, very little, if any, progress had been made, this being due largely to the state of the ground, which was in most places up to knees in mud and shell holes full of water. As the 1st 4th Oxfords had not vacated their assembly trenches, we were ordered to halt at a line 300 yards east of the Steenbeek and dig in and find any available cover. At 9:55 p.m, Springfield, another one of those farms that had been converted into a defensive position, was reported to have been taken, and this proved correct. And that's as far as they got, really. They didn't move. A fairly insignificant day, really, in the history of the Battle of Ypres, of Langemark, of the Great War. But the battalion diary tells us that whilst they were digging in, whilst they were looking for some kind of cover when there wasn't any, two officers were wounded 12 other ranks were killed, 29 were wounded, which isn't too bad, but the battalion was only at half strength because of the number of casualties that they'd taken 11 days before, and it was eventually established that 20 men died on that day, and George was one of them. 16 of them have no known grave and are remembered on the Tynecott Memorial. And we know that George was buried close to where he fell, because the burial report in the Common War Graves Commission archives is dated the 23rd of February 1920, and it reveals that his body was found alongside an unknown British soldier, probably from the same unit, and one other man from the Oxford and Bucks. They were found in the same location, four of them, in fact, and they were taken to New Irish Farm and buried. And that's where he lies today. New Irish Farm is just outside of Ypres. It was first used from August to November 1917 and was named, as so many of them were, after a nearby farm. It was used again in April and May of 1918. And when the armistice came around, there was just 73 burials there. But then, not just George, but 4,500 others were brought in from the battlefields northeast of Ypres. And some of the smaller battlefield cemeteries were closed down as well. A vast majority of them, as you'd expect, are unknown. But George was identified. And it was there that we went to next. Although, as we said earlier, David had come very close to stopping there on the coach tour he'd been to several years ago. This was to be the first time in his life that he'd seen his relative's grave. The first thing he did when we entered the cemetery was to stop and find the visitor's book that contains a register of all the burials behind a magnificent bronze door. Left him alone whilst he wrote his thoughts in that book. He had in his hand a small wooden cross with a poppy on it, supplied, of course, as we know, by the Royal British Legion. And then after a few minutes of searching, we found his grave and the other three soldiers that died with him that day that were found with him in 1920. And David spent some time crouched down with his hands over his eyes, shielding his eyes from the spring sunshine. After a few moments, he stood behind his grave, behind that Portland headstone. There was no personal inscription on the base of the headstone. But he stood there all the same, thinking about the relative that he never knew, thinking about what he went through around Hillock Farm, around St. Julian, around that muddy Steenbeek. I don't know what else was in David's mind. He didn't say very much. He's a very quiet, reserved man. But I do know it meant a lot to him, as it always does when we bring people on these pilgrimages. But there was more to do, a lot more, as we'll see in the next section of the podcast.
Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile. While you've a Lucifer to light your fag, smile, boys, that's the style. What's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. So pack up your troubles in your old kit.
So that night, we dined well in one of the restaurants around the Grote Market in Ypres. We attended the last post ceremony, of course, met up with a few Belgian friends, drunk some of the very strong beer they served there, and then we rested, and we rested well, because the next day we had quite a long journey, an hour and a half further south, a journey that took us right to the end of the Great War, to October of 1918, and we're following another one, another of David's relatives, this one called Jesse Scragg. And he'd been killed in action on the 25th of October 1918. Everyone says, oh, so many of these men died so close to the armistice. Well, this was a very dangerous place to be on the battlefield, as we saw, as we followed his journey. Because There were no deep trenches, no defensive positions, no pillboxes to hide behind. Just vast open fields and roads as they pushed the Germans back. Great progress was being made, but this was fighting that was really akin to what we saw in the Second World War. Fast-moving gains measured in miles rather than yards. But of course, those trenches were horrible places to be, but they gave you quite a lot of safety. And without those deep trenches, the men are pursuing the Germans across those open fields. There's villages. Every couple of miles or so, every village has buildings and church towers that they can, German defenders can use as machine gun positions and observation positions. The Germans still had fight in them. And it meant that so many men became casualties during those last few weeks of the war. And Jesse was to prove one of them while serving with the 2nd 4th Battalion of the Oxford and Box Light Infantry. He also had served after the 1st of January of 1916. And their battalion diary had been neatly typed up, which makes such a massive difference when we're following these soldiers' stories. And it tells us that on Friday the 11th of October 1918, they were in reserve and carrying out training exercises west of Bourlon Wood, that same wood that had seen so much action in 1917 during the Battle of Cambrai, and which the Canadians had taken a few weeks earlier and was now behind the British line that had moved forward. On the 24th of October, they moved forward themselves. Battalion diary tells us that they were at a place called St. Aubert, or St. Aubert, A-U-B-E-R-T. I'm not quite sure how the French would pronounce it. It says, at 1600 hours, the battalion moved forward through the villages of St. Martin and Bermain, which were heavily shelled, and they attacked the enemy positions northeast of the Rognew River. The attack was completely successful against considerable hostile opposition. One enemy officer, one other rank and two machine guns were captured, and also considerable enemy war material. Heavy casualties were inflicted on the enemy in the fighting. And then on Friday the 25th of October, this is the day that Jesse was to lose his life, tells us at 2:30 in the afternoon, two companies continue the advance across a railway and successfully force the passage of a stream and storm the high ground on its eastern side in the face of the enemy's machine gun fire coming from the direction of the village of Marichess, M-A-R-E-S-C-H-E-S. Again, I'm sure I've slaughtered that. Terrible with these pronunciations. A line was established at dusk 1,000 yards east of Septmeries, S-E-P-M-E-I-E-S. It says, with the 1st Royal Barks of the 2nd Division on the battalion's right and the 2nd 4th Royal Barks on its left, during the night of the 25th and 26th of October, the position remained unchanged. Casualties, other ranks, 5 killed, 22 wounded. And Jesse was one of those that was killed during that advance. Now, the previous day, when we'd followed in the footsteps of George Scragg, it was possible using linesmen to stand within a few metres or yards on the very spot that he died. It wasn't the case here. Linesman doesn't record where those defensive positions were or even the attacking positions because there was no time to draw trench maps. All we knew was that between those two villages is where they attacked from, and somewhere over the course of 2 or 3 miles is where Jesse had been killed. But he has no known grave. Only one of those 5 men that died that day have a known grave. Jesse hasn't, and for the men that died during those last few weeks, they are remembered on a memorial called the Vis en Artois Memorial to the Missing. There's a cemetery there as well. There's nearly 10,000 men that died during those last few weeks that have no known grave. It's not often visited, this memorial, unless you have a reason to go there. I've now been there 4 or 5 times for various reasons, and that's where we went, not to lay a wreath or a cross on a grave, because there wasn't one, but to find Jesse's name on the memorial that David had actually visited on that battlefield tour in 2019. We had more time this time, of course. Late afternoon, we were tired, ready for a drink. We'd followed his journey all afternoon, and we ended it with David pointing and thinking about Jesse's name, pointing at his name inscribed on the memorial. That's all we'd got. That was the whole point, wasn't it, of those memorials to the missing, where there's no grave somewhere that closure can be obtained, and closure it was. We also went during our journey that afternoon to, I mentioned, St. Aubert, A-U-B-E-R-T, and there's a small cemetery there that I've been to many times over the years because there's quite a lot of soldiers buried there from my hometown of Northampton. And when I was in our local library recently, I came across an incredible photograph that I had with me. It was a photograph of a family, of a mum and dad and a lad that had gone to see the grave of their son that was buried in St. Aubert Cemetery. And they had their photograph standing by their son's grave. It was so soon after the war in 1919 that the Portland headstone had not yet been erected. There was a wooden cross there. And I took that photo with me and I placed it against the headstone. And we read the newspaper article that accompanied the photo that I'd found in the Northampton Independent. And this is what it said about what must have been an incredibly emotional journey for the relatives of Private Walter John Colton, service number 39617, B Company, 7th Battalion, Northamptonshire Regiment, died on the 9th of October 1918, aged 28 years old. The report says that Mr. and Mrs. W.G. Colton of the Roebuck Inn, Grafton Street, Northampton, had the sad experience of visiting the grave of their only son. During the journey, they saw the graves of several other Northampton men, and as the results of their visit may be of interest to other bereaved relatives, we sought permission of Mr. Colton to use the above photograph and the following particulars. Mr. and Mrs. Colton and a friend of their son, a Mr. S. Fisher, who served in France with the Canadians, journeyed privately to Cambrai and found their son's grave some 15 miles north of that place. They strongly recommend, however, that visits should be made through the agency of the YMCA, whose facilities make the journey both easy and comfortable. They arrived at Amiens. Amiens is quite a long way from Cambrai, probably, a couple of hours, I should think, if they were to drive in those days. But it says that they arrived at Amiens fatigued and tired by their inability to speak French. They followed a party being conducted by the Red Triangle. Although not belonging to them, they were immediately made welcome and given excellent meals and installed in adequate quarters. That same evening, Mr. Colton mentioned to somebody locally that their son-in-law, a Private Holloway of the London Regiment, was killed in action in France, and to his surprise, one of the officials said that he believed he was buried in a cemetery nearby. The gentleman also offered to take Mr. and Mrs. Colton to the grave the next day, and he conveyed them by motor car to the cemetery. The grave proved to be that of Mr. Colton's son-in-law, and the coincidence was all the more remarkable in that the family had no idea where the deceased son fell or even was buried. The next day, Mr. and Mrs. Colton and Mr. Fisher went to Cambrai, and arriving at the cemetery, found the grave of their son knee-deep in grass. Mr. Colton and Mr. Fisher then procured a spade, and with the aid of this and an old bayonet which they picked up, they trimmed the grave and planted it with flowers and evergreens. Then they noticed that the adjoining grave bore the name of 2nd Lieutenant Cutting, B Company, the 7th Northants, and with kindly thought, they trimmed up this grave too. In the photograph, they are seen just finishing their task with the grave of Lieutenant Cutting on their left. Mr. Colton, who lost a son, a half-brother and a son-in-law in France, says that contrary to the general idea, visits to the graves in France are comparatively easy, especially when undertaken through the YMCA. The French people everywhere are kind and considerate, and the fact that anyone is on a mission of visitation is sufficient to gain them facilities all along the route. He's willing to place at the disposal of any relatives who contemplate visiting the Cambrai area the results of his experience. Though he was unwilling to make publicity of his visit, his courtesy in allowing us to use the above details will, we feel sure, be appreciated by others who were also bereaved. And you'd hope that was the case, wouldn't you? I mean, you know, France isn't very far off for us now. Wherever we are in the UK, we can easily get down to Folkestone or to Dover, make the short hop across on the Eurotunnel on the ferry It wasn't so easy then, of course. There was all sorts of reasons why people wouldn't be able to get over there. But they did. They went in their tens of thousands, as we know. The photograph that we're talking about is entitled "The Soldier's Son, A Sad Pilgrimage." It clearly shows Mrs. Corton dressed in her black, and the father and that young soldier that served with the Canadians, Fisher, standing there with their spade and their bayonet that he'd found. You can clearly see the bayonet in Fisher's right hand, and the lovely wreath that they'd laid on the grave. I'll put that on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk, and also of the modern Portland headstone, with this photograph laid up against it that I took last week. Now, what happened to that wooden cross? Well, it's here in Northampton. It's here in the Dallington Cemetery, because the newspapers tell us again that the actual wooden cross from the grave of a buried soldier son buried in one of the British war cemeteries in France is the cherished possession of Mrs. Sarah Colton. Their son, William, listed in the 7th North Ants in May 1915, and was killed in action. A short time ago, Mrs. Colton and her husband, who since died, made up their minds to go to France and see the grave of their son. They were so impressed with the wooden cross and the neat manner in which the inscription had been carried out that they applied to the Imperial War Graves Commission to know if the cross could be sent home in the safekeeping of the mother and father, and this request was immediately acceded to. And another article tells us in, this was in 1924, that just before Christmas on December the 19th, the vicar of St Andrew's Church consecrated in the cemetery at Dallington the regimental cross which had been removed from the grave of Colton. And what I've got to do now when I get time is go up to that cemetery, look for the family grave of the Coltons and see if that wooden cross is still there. Bearing in mind this is 101 years later and it was made of wood. I very much doubt it, but you never know. I'll let you know what happens. 1924 was clearly a very sad year for the family, the Coltons, because that was the year that the cross came back to them, and it must have brought back sad memories of what had happened to Walter. Their youngest daughter died that year, and coincidentally, she was the same age as Walter, 28 years old. There's nothing really significant about that cemetery. It's one of those that you'd pass by. It's not on a main road or anything, down a quiet country lane. And unless you had a reason to go there, you'd never go there. But there was something very special. So I placed that photograph there and read the story, and I placed my hand on the headstone afterwards. Sorry, I've just read to you. I read to the two people that were with me. It felt somehow that we were returning the family that, of course, will all be dead themselves now, the mum and dad that went and Fisher that went that on that day all those years ago. It felt that we were returning them to their son. They wouldn't have seen the Portland headstone, but we were seeing it. We were connecting up the past to the present. And I'll go again. Our journey across the battlefields will take us in that direction again one day. And when I do, I'll go and visit Walter, and I hope if you're that way, you'll go and see him as well. But there was one other story that I'd like to leave you with today, and it takes us back to the salient, to the cemetery, Cement House Cemetery, one of those large concentration burial grounds that was established in the 1920s. Again, going through the Northampton newspaper archive, I've discovered the photograph of Private Ernest Manton, service number 40622, serving with the 2nd Battalion of the South Wales Borderers, who died in the mud of Passchendaele on the 6th of October 1917. Battalion diary tells us that they were being kept in reserve in the vicinity of Langemark, which is only a stone's throw away from where he's now buried. Hostile shelling was fairly heavy till 6:30 a.m., and after that, until about 11:30 a.m, the whole area was very quiet. But at some stage on that day, this young man was killed. Again, I'll put his photograph on the podcast page of my website. It shows a very young man with a centre part in a civilian suit. He's wearing a dicky bow, and the face that's staring back at me is extremely young. Everyone seems young, don't they, when you get older? But he looks particularly young. He was just 19 years old. And the newspaper article that went with the photograph told us that he lived at number 27 Abington Square. And it's Abington Square where, in 1937, the 3,000 names of the men from Northampton that didn't return from the Great War were engraved on the war memorial that's there, just yards away from where Ernest lived with his parents. They didn't call him Ernest, they called him Lou. That was his nickname. And he'd joined up in January of 1917, and two of his brothers were serving, and thankfully they both came back. The battalion padre was a man called Swallow, and Swallow wrote a letter to the bereaved parents, and it's these words that drew me to his grave. He said, "I knew your boy intimately all the time he was with us. He's the only one whom I can never forget, cheery and smiling under all circumstances, straight and upright in character, and a splendid young soldier, worthy of the town he came from and of the home he died to defend. His smile was like a ray of sunshine on a dull day." There's a very faint smile in that photo of young Lou Ernest. And it's his story that I'd like to leave with this week. Thank you for tuning in and joining us on the pilgrimage to the battlefields with David Murphy and his three relatives. Two didn't come back. One did, came back with a Distinguished Conduct Medal. They're not extraordinary soldiers. They're not extraordinary men. Normal men carrying out extraordinary actions and achieving extraordinary results, doing things that me and you can only imagine, and be thankful that we've never been called on to carry out the same actions that these young men did. There's no way that there would be a smile on my face if I was having to do it. I'd be grateful if you could, if you haven't already, review and rate this podcast wherever you get it from, especially if it's on Spotify or Apple. They seem to be the two favourite places to download it. And as usual, we'll remember all of the soldiers that we've talked about this week by the playing of The Last Post.